If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
But you know, basically, I grew up in the wine business. Like it or not, that's how I grew up.
First of all, consider that to can say that a grape variety is doing well in a specific vineyard, you need a generation minimum. Yeah.
I've had some great experiences. That's the fun part. You get to find these things. And you don't always have to drink a $50 bottle. You can find a great $12 bottle that's like, wow, that's amazing.
A lot of people think that you just grow the grapes, pick them, throw it in a tank and stomp on the grapes and hey presto, you've got wine. If it were only that simple, It's not.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 446. This week we feature Erica Crawford, founder and CEO of Love Block Wine in New Zealand. COVID may have put many businesses on hold, but the wine industry never stops. As wine lovers, we are very thankful for that. New projects are also a constant, often from well-established wine veterans. Erica Crawford is founder and CEO of Love Block Wine in New Zealand, and in terms of viticulture, she never stops. We spoke with Erica on the phone recently to talk about making organic wine and her dedication to that craft. Listen to Erica on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term African sweetgrass. Well, we're doing a long-distance call today. We are talking to Erica Crawford of Love Block Wines, and she is in New Zealand, which is pretty darn cool, and it's early in the morning. How are you, Erica?
I'm very well, thank you, Ray. Black and breezy.
Yeah, so let me see. This is June for us, so are you in colder months now there?
Yeah, we've just officially gone into the height of winter.
Yeah, totally different than where we're at. And I wish you a good winter. We're glad to have it in our rearview mirror.
It's not as bad here as it can be in some of the parts of the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, I know. You're lucky that way. But New Zealand, I've never been, but what I've seen is an incredibly beautiful country. I'm assuming you're from there originally. Is that correct?
No, I'm not from here originally. I grew up in Africa, in South Africa to be precise, and then met my boy and came over here as a 20-something-year-old, 28-year-old, and I'm still here.
Wow, so you must have liked it, I guess.
And still married to the same bloke.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, I always like to kind of trace people's background, and I'm sure you've been asked this question a few hundred thousand times, but for you, entering into the wine industry as a professional and as well as a person who simply created a love of wine, was there an aha moment for you? Was there a time you thought, this is something I'd really like to do more with or learn more about?
It was nothing that romantic, Ray, actually. It was in fact, very practical. We had two babies 13 months apart, and I just left my proper day job, you know, where I worked for a German diagnostics company. Clearly, it was going to pose a problem to pursue that career. So Kim, my husband, was already a young winemaker, and so we decided that making an own little brand would be a good thing to do for our little family, you know. And, of course, we would have known that it would be sprouting to one of New Zealand's biggest and most valuable brands, that Kim Crawford brand.
Yeah, I'd say you did fairly well with that.
We did all right, I think.
But now, probably quite a bit of what we're going to talk about today is Love Block Wines, which is probably even more of a passion project for you. Is that fair to say?
It's probably a homey passion project because if you speak to the accountants, they will tell you that we probably have rocks in our heads and not the brains that we've always been credited with. You know, two things for me. I want to talk about just the practice and the values of Love Block, and then I want to talk a little bit about physically how it came about. So I'll start with the physically how it came about. We already owned, by the time we sold Kim Crawford, we had to go into a non-compete for a few years, obviously. And during that time, we were allowed to be grape growers, and we had already earned 45 hectares, about 100 acres of vineyard land, which we had to buy and mortgage ourselves to the hilt for to supply the King Crawford brand, mainly with Pinot Noir. So we had that vineyard. We then purchased something that totally stole our hearts, but it's one of the most difficult growing environments in the whole of Marlborough. No one has planted grapes in a place like this before. And it's challenging, but I think that the flavors coming off out there and off the blocks are completely satisfying. So that's what the accountants say we do silly. So you get these low crops, difficult, high input vineyards, they need a lot of human hands, but the flavors we think are incredible. So, and then of course, I fell in love with the view standing up there on the hill. It's an incredible view. If you do go to the Lock Block site, at some stage we will launch the new site and you'll see a photograph of that view. That's just that place that lifts your troubles off your shoulders for a moment and you feel like you can see the end of the earth. So we then bought this piece of land, which is now the Lock Block Farm. And secondly, the whole thing is predicated on, I guess, organic values, which for me started in my early 30s when we're just busy with it. Life is so busy when you've got little kids and you've got a job and the company's growing and life doesn't go always work out well, does it? And my father was dying in Africa, so I smacked my car into a lamppost, and as you typically do when you're not fully focused. And only a few minor scrapes, but
that's good.
Obviously, I had to be checked out, and they told me that I presented like a stressed-out 55-year-old corporate businessman. Of course, I was neither. I was especially offended by the 55-year-old. So I just started cleaning up my life a little. I cut out Diet Coke was the first thing to go, and then I learned how to read food labels and started cutting out all those the additives and the colorants, and as far as it's almost impossible in life to avoid those things, but as far as I can, And then looked at skincare and changed to natural skincare as far as I could. And the next step then was how we clean the house. And that, of course, is a chemical bath, isn't it? That's just around you all the time. So
sure.
We use a lot of baking soda and vinegar and a bit of elbow grease and soft products. And so Lock Block was really just the next logical step to view differently to just a vineyard. So, we focus on organic farming, where it's not organic, there's a low input regime. So across our vineyard, so that's where we're at, yeah. So it definitely is a labor of love.
I would say so. And I guess that's where the name came from. Yeah, I put two and two together. Once in a while, I figure things out.
Yeah, because over here, we, of course, refer to vineyards, several vineyards. If they're broken down individually to little parts in Australia and New Zealand, we tend to refer to them as blocks.
Sure. I think the idea of being organic is still a little bit confusing to some wine lovers. And how do you explain that to someone other than the obvious? This is something that is not chemically oriented. This is something as much from the earth as possible. Because maybe somebody would say, well, I'm not sure about that kind of wine.
Yeah, I think, firstly, the major difference is that we don't use any chemical herbicides, pesticides in the vineyard. So that's usually done to bring in more efficiencies, so that if you look at herbicide by itself, and just think Roundup that most people use in their gardens, right?
Yeah.
It leaves the vine in an environment where it doesn't have to compete with anything for nutrients and for food. So that's the function of herbicide. So with our guys, they have to fight with the weeds that grow between them. They have to fight with a cover crop. We practice regenerative agriculture, so they've got to fight with that. And so it does make it the harder, so your crop is always lower. And, you just have more human hands on the vines than you would otherwise. And, of course, in New Zealand, people have been very clever. We have to mechanize to a great extent because we've got such a labor problem here. But that's the thing about herbicides. Pesticides would be things that you spray for, you know, pest and disease that can manifest in the vines, such as powdery mildew is a bit of a problem for us here in New Zealand, and whatever else there is that you need to deal to at the time. So we obviously can't do those either. The other major thing is commercial fertilizers, you know, the stuff that you buy, that you just from, you know, from the shops and the big companies that provide the macronutrients, we don't do those either. So we really rely on soil health and soil fertility to give to the vines whatever they need.
Nice. From my point of view also, and you correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that because you are organic, you're giving the vines a bit more than average tender, loving care.
Yeah, they definitely demand that. You know, for instance, as I say, because we don't spray herbicide, you have to actually physically go and mow those weeds. And in New Zealand, because in Marlborough particularly, where we are, the soil is so fast draining that you need to irrigate. Otherwise, they won't have any water sitting in the soil. It's different for different regions and different countries, the water use. But for us, we have to irrigate. And of course, if you irrigate the vine, the weeds grow as well. So that's probably our biggest expense, and that we have to do that quite often. Yeah, and we do treat them differently. You know, we also, of course, have some vineyards or vineyard blocks that are not yet organic. It's a very long game, and, you know, if you think that we have 110 hectares under vine across all the properties, then, and what's that? That's about 250 acres or something.
Sure.
It's a big commitment. So every year, you know, we take 3 to 5 hectares. So that's about 10 to 15 acres a year that we start in the conversion process, but it's a long process.
Sure.
So we're getting there. But I just want to make sure that everyone understands that some of the vineyards are managed organically and some are not quite there yet.
But the goal is to be there then?
Yes, okay. Hopefully, one day.
I was able to try your Sauvignon Blanc, and I have to tell you, I'm probably a bit prejudiced anyway because I'm a huge fan of Sauvignon Blanc, and I really love it from New Zealand. Mm. A beautiful wine, wonderful body, my compliments. And I'm a little curious, though, about your quantities of the wines you're going to be releasing. About how many cases are you doing at this point?
At this point, we're sitting about 28,000 cases. So that's small in the scheme of things, and because we're an estate proposition, which is something that's quite scarce and rare in New Zealand, there's a cap on the estate. So we still got a room to go, quite a bit of room to go. So we also sell, of course, quite a bit of grapes at this time. But we're not growing without constraints. This is not what I want to do this time. Yeah.
Let's talk about the wines you're making. Obviously, I mentioned Sauvignon Blanc. What else are you making?
So to the US, we also send in some Pinot Gris. And I think if you haven't tried Pinot Gris from New Zealand, do try, because I think with our cool climate here, it just gives you that lovely intense expression of the grape. It sort of sits somewhere between Alsace and Pinot Grigio. So it's quite an interesting iteration. The other one that we send to the US is Pinot Noir. And later in the year, and early next year, we'll be launching a no-sulfur added Sauvignon Blanc, which is quite interesting and something we can talk about separately as well, because I'm quite excited about that. Then in very small amounts, we make a Wurzburgerina. We just going to pick our first bit of Chardonnay next year. We make Riesling and made a first tiny little batch of orange wine. And we've just planted a bit of Syrah. So these are all tiny, itty-bitty little bits. I'm talking, you know, 100 cases or so.
Sure. Well, those are kind of fun, though, too.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, other than needing to make a profit and operate a business, wine is supposed to be fun. And you know, when you could experiment, as I've always said, winemakers tend to be mad scientists. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I think the one good thing that we're seeing is that there's less and less input. So people are trying to let the wine speak a lot more of its space. So I think across the world, people are, or certainly in New Zealand, we're all trying to fiddle less with the wine in the winery. So that's certainly a trend over here. But yeah, it's a nice mixture between being a farmer, being a scientist, and have a little bit of artistry in there as well.
You had mentioned Sauvignon Blanc, and I believe you said low or no sulfur. Is that what you were mentioning?
No sulfur.
No sulfur. Yeah, tell me about that. I'm curious.
If we were to talk about the organic certification in the world, then you'll set me off on a terrible rant because it's different for different places. And one of the difficult things, certification for the U.S., for instance, you can't add any sulfur to the wine. And even if we make it off organically grown grapes, you can't say it's organic because there's also something that we've got to tweak in the winemaking. And so that's a different system. Australia, New Zealand, and the EU work on one system, and that dictates that sulfur has got to be below 100 parts per minute. So all the wine, whether it's organic or not, is made in that way. So a low sulfur regime. And then that sets us off. How do we get the sulfur lower without compromising the wine and its not being spoiled? So we know that two things. In South Africa, people have been playing with rooibos tea for a little while and all sorts of things. And then secondly, there already was a product in the wine sphere, by the enological suppliers, that was sitting there and no one had used it, and that's a green tea extract. And so essentially, we've all known that green tea is antioxidant. You know, we get told that to use it in skincare and drink it and all sorts of things. And people have been doing it for centuries. And so we had a little trial in 2018, no idea how to do this. So essentially, no sulfur, and every time the wine is exposed to oxygen, it gets a 5 milligrams per liter of this high-grade green tea extract. So it's essentially an enological tannin, and that protects the wine. So the first one, in 2018, we ran out of this precious stuff on the last pass. So the wine had to go from the tank into the truck, across the pass into Blenheim, which is about a good 40-45 minute drive, to the bottling company, into a tank, and then to be bottled. So it was exposed to oxygen for quite a period of time. And it turned quite orange. It's sort of that technical term is pinking, oxidative pinking. And then lo and behold, later it cleared up. So what essentially, there are two trains of thought technically. How does it work? Firstly, it blocks an enzyme. That's the easy, that's the most obvious pathway for how this antioxidant works. But at the heart of antioxidants, it manages sort of redox balance, doesn't it? And so in these oxidative circumstances sometimes, oxygen loses an electron. And the other electron that's left on the molecule is highly... it really wants to pair with another electron. So it's just lost its little mate. And then it goes around and randomly strips electrons from other molecules. That's not always a good thing. So what green tea does is to kindly donate an electron to this oxygen molecule, and the thing becomes stable again. So that's it, at the very base of it, how it works.
Interesting. Wow. Very different approach.
So what we found, I'll just tell you this. So once the wine cleared up after being orange, what sulfur does, in my opinion, is it really grabs onto flavors quite hard and it holds it. So it's almost, it tries to hold it in the moment of time. But this approach really lets the flavors flow a bit more wildly. So it's Sauvignon Blanc, and as someone said, it's opening another door to Sauvignon Blanc. So obviously, the following year, we were a little bit more better versed in the thing, and the wine was quite, the wine's stable and the wine doesn't spoil, and you can leave it open for at least 5 days. So, of course, the flavors develop a little bit, like all wine does once a bottle's been opened, but this is just super interesting, yeah. And I also think as people lean more towards less additive thing and looking for natural alternatives, this has been quite popular.
It's a very interesting journey that you and your husband are on. It's something I think more and more people are going to be aware of as time goes on. Is there a lesson or a mantra you live by in the wine industry, something that you look to as being something that you absolutely go for, obviously other than quality, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously sort of, I think the emphasis looks to me like it's shifting a bit more to the vineyard away from the winemaker and tinkering in the winery. I don't know. Winemakers will slaughter me for that. But I'm pretty culturally changed, so obviously that's where my love sits. So, but everybody across the board, we see quite a migration here towards organic growing, and it's growers all shapes and sizes. So we see that happening. People just really looking for less tinkering and let the grape do its own thing. I know people have been saying that forever, but this time we're really seeing an influence of that. I suppose, and I'm not sure whether I want to get into this clean wine thing, but that's actually really made for whatever it is, it's really made people aware of what to look for in wine, I think, strangely.
So in New Zealand, for our listeners who don't really understand anything about the climate there and the wine growing area, can you talk about that a little bit in terms of what your challenges are?
So New Zealand's a long, skinny little country, and it's snugly in the size of Israel. So, also long and skinny. Probably if you think of California, Oregon is entirely different to Southern California, and this is a little bit what you see with New Zealand as well. So the North Island, the soils here tend to be volcanic. I mean, the beautiful thing about New Zealand is that it's got all these natural things going on, like you're either sitting on a fault line or near a volcano. Okay, so North Island's got the volcanoes. So the soil is very, very fertile. It tends to be a little bit more, especially the northern parts, tend to be a lot more tropical, tend to be a lot more humid. And as you get further south, of course, it gets colder and colder. The South Island is a completely different beast, where the soils are nothing like the North Island. And, you can see the two virtually touch each other. Where the soil in the Marlborough area we are certainly is glacial, which means that these big ice mountains basically stripped through the land and formed this soil for us. And just happens to grow, Sauvignon Blanc and other aromatics so well. And then if you go further south to Central Otago, that's a different beast altogether, where you see schist and limestone and things that we don't see in other parts of the country. So a really small country, but really versatile and different in each region.
Naturally made for wine.
I think so.
Yeah, I would say so too. Many parts of the world, and here in the United States, many wineries and many companies in general are having a difficult time finding labor, whether they're interns, whether they're full-time, part-time.
Yeah.
Is that something you've experienced in New Zealand?
Oh, don't get me started. This is a massive problem for not only for wine growers, but of course also for stone fruit, pit fruit. This year it was just tragic how many apples were just left to rot on the trees and on the ground. Same with kiwi fruit and stuff, because for those jobs we've always relied on backpackers, and we have a scheme with the Pacific Islands where people come in and do those jobs, and it's not unskilled work, especially pruning for grapes. So last year we were lucky in that as COVID landed, we still had the workers from Pacific Islands, and they stayed for longer. But this year is going to be a problem for us. So we've actually increased our own staff by about 7 and invested in good old electric secateurs so we can do as much of the pruning ourselves as possible. But yeah, major problem.
What about mechanical harvesting? Is that something you've investigated?
That, of course, has been our saving grace, and because that's why the grape industry is perhaps not as affected as the stone fruit in this industry and kiwi fruit and the likes of the tree-grown fruits, is that we've been doing mechanical harvesting in New Zealand for years, New Zealand and Australia, typically because of the labour issue, and it was, it came as a result of short labour shortage. So last year in COVID, not only did we pivot more towards mechanical for labor shortage, but also for safety. You know, just we were so scared, weren't we, in the beginning of COVID? We had no idea what was going to happen.
Sure.
So mechanical harvesting, we try to pick about, hand pick about 15% of the, probably be more like 25% of crop. But it's just not possible with the labor we have in New Zealand to do it all by hand. And because your windows are so small, you know, when you have to pick, you have to pick.
Right. Well, I don't know where you are at in New Zealand in terms of COVID. I know that you've done fairly well, if I'm not mistaken, over this last year. Is that right?
Yes. It's, New Zealand and Australia followed the, it's not a philosophy, I suppose, the strategy of elimination. So, which means our borders are closed. And if you do come in, you have to be a citizen or have to have some sort of release from the government and then go into 2 weeks managed isolation, which means you're in a hotel room for 2 weeks and you're not let out, sort of thing. But it has meant that our lives can pretty much carry on as per normal. We've just, in Australia and New Zealand, we've got a little mini outbreak at the moment, but, you know, it's the first time in quite a while. And people are very, very careful, you know. You just get locked down for a few cases, although we're sort of learning to manage it more on little micro-lockdowns now. Yeah. But, yeah, we've had sports games with 50,000 people present for the last year. We've had concerts and all sorts of things. And we're now able to travel to Australia, which I'm very pleased about, of course.
Nice. Well, now, this is probably something we just touched on right there, but what makes you, and this could go either positive or negative, what makes you crazy about the wine business?
What I absolutely love about it, Ray, I have to say, it's the people. And I know people always say that, but, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. And the other thing that, of course, is how different wines, the wines come out every vintage, but people are so important, right, from tilling the soil to making the wine to selling the wine to drinking the wine. And throughout that supply chain in my life, I've met some wonderful people. And people have been very good to me, you know, particularly the people in the U.S., because that's one of the first places we went to with King Crawford, and we're back again with Lovelock. But it's people. And then secondly, of course, is just how the nuances of difference between the years. And, you know, it's not like Coca-Cola. People who don't expect a vintage difference can struggle with that, but it's not like we add water, acid, and sugar. You have to take what it is. What drives me mad about it is that it's a funny old thing in life, you know. All our costs are increasing so much. Minimum wage here has gone up to $20 an hour. Freight, the whole lot. And people are prepared to pay more for a gnarly apple and this, that, and the other. You know, you expect a price increase on your clothes every year and your shoes, et cetera. But still, wine is a thing that just does not move in price. And especially, I think, sort of in the organic sector, people are still not prepared to pay more for that than they are for something that's made in a completely different way that focuses on efficiencies rather than, that extreme care.
Sure. So what has become my favorite question to ask winemakers is, for the time you've done media and interviews, what's the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, that's something that you just bringing on me, right?
yes.
What is one question that I haven't been asked and I'd like to be asked? The one question people, the one statement, I guess it's more a statement than a question is just, you know, I think that the role of the viticulturist is largely underrated. And I get really mad when viticultural work is attributed to a winemaker, you know?
Yeah.
Because they're two completely different disciplines.
Yes, they are.
We all know a little bit about what the other one is doing, but they're two completely different principles. And, you know, there's assumption that winemakers know about vineyards, but there's no assumption that viticulturists know about wine. It's a funny old thing. Yeah, so that makes me mad, and that's a question I haven't been asked.
Well, that was a good answer for that. Thank you. Now, at this point, if I'm not mistaken, Lovelock is not available in the States, but it will be a little bit later this year. Is that correct?
Right. We've had unbelievable freight problems, some shipping problems. And I think everybody's in the same boat here. So right now we're in a little out-of-stock situation because the freight has been a nightmare.
So when do you think it will? I mean, is that a difficult answer for that?
No, there's some stuff on the water right now. So it is going. It just takes a long time to get onto a ship. It's the availability of shipping space that's the major problem. And, of course, because New Zealand's out in the little limb at the end of the world here,
yes.
They have to take a little detour to come to us, so it makes it doubly as difficult. But we should have some stock soon again. But for now, yeah, we're struggling a little bit. Everybody, with all goods, I think if you go to Kmart and you're trying to buy an electric kettle or an iron, you'll see that many other shelf spaces are empty. So that's our reality for... But I suppose that's our COVID reality, and hopefully, I don't know what happened to all those shipping containers who were there before, but hopefully they can put them on the water again because it's getting quite dire for us.
Sure. It's happening all over, and it's something that none of us are used to, but hopefully it'll take time, I'm sure, but it will sort it out. Most importantly, for our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you and LoveBlock online, what is your website?
So the website is loveblockwine.com. Instagram is loveblockwine, as well as Twitter, but you tend to get a little bit of my rambles on there as well. So we're all over the place. The website's having a rebuild, so please bear with us. It's really ugly at the moment. but we'll have a pretty new site with all sorts of pictures to you on there quite soon.
Very good. Erica, thank you very much for taking the time, especially early in the morning. And again, I know it's not that early, but New Zealand's a bit of a jog for us. And I wish you tremendous success with LoveBlock.
Thank you very much. And I just really want to thank the people of the U.S., as I say, who've been very kind to both Kim and I over probably in the last 20 years in our various iterations. It's always a pleasure to visit, and I do hope to be back soon.
Visit loveblockwine.com to learn more.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2021.